Good morning, everybody. And my name is John Case, and you're listening to Enlightened Radio on www.enlightenedradio.org. And we're going to be going on vacation here for a couple of weeks here after today as we kind of restructure a little bit. We spent about 9 months here in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, getting the studio set up and getting everything working. And I'd say we've done that, and so now it's time to reorganize a little bit. And so we're going to do that. It's going to take a couple of weeks, and we'll be playing mostly programmed music and old-time radio in the meantime. But today we have the 253rd, I believe, poetry show. Janet Harrison, my good friend and the host here of this program, and she does all the work for it every week. And we're going to be listening to the poetry of, and Janet Harrison, tell me who that is.
Samuel Hazo.
Hold on a second now. No.
Samuel Hazo. Okay. The son of Lebanese and Syrian immigrants, Samuel Hazo was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, on July 19th, 1928. So he's 88 years old. After his mother died, when he was only 6 years old, his aunt became the primary caretaker for his brother and him. In 1949, he graduated magna cum laude from the University of Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana, and then enlisted in the Marine Corps, serving as a captain. Returning to Pittsburgh after his military service, he earned an M.A. from Duquesne University and a Ph.D. from the University of Pittsburgh. An extremely prolific writer, Samuel Hazo has published in many genres, novels, plays, essays, a memoir, and a film script, and more than 30 books of poetry and translations. Among his recent publications are The Song of the Horse, a selection of poems 1958 to 2008, Autumn House Press, 2008, and They Rule the World, Syracuse University Press, 2016. He founded the International Poetry Forum in 1966. The organization brought more than 800 poets and performers to Pittsburgh, including such luminaries as Seamus Heaney and Robert Pinsky. Additionally, he taught English, 1955 to 1998, and served as an associate dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, 1961 to 1966, at Duquesne University. In 1993, he was appointed Poet Laureate of Pennsylvania, a position he held for a decade. His poetry is both personal and political, and has been praised by poets such as Naomi Shihab Nye and Martine Espada. Responding with approval to a remark a friend wrote him in a letter, "Knowing is stifling, not knowing is creative," Hazo commented, "We live in a world obsessed with the ultimate value of information and the pursuit of the factual over the ambiguous, the obscure, the mysterious." He goes on to draw an important distinction between the language of communication, everything from conversation to journalism, from text messaging to expository prose and the language of communion, poetic statements, the arts and literature. He states, "Life, however, is by nature not static, is ultimately a mystery. It has more in common with what we cannot know than what we do know." This week's featured poem, "Only the New Branches Bloom," is from Song of the Horse, a selection of poems from 1958 to 2008, Autumn House Press, 2008. And he didn't indicate which book it was originally published in, so I don't have that information. "Only the New Branches Bloom." Denying what it means to doubt, this year's forsythias unfold and flood the air with yellow answers. They say it's time I opened up, time I learned French, time I liked less and loved more, time I listened to the sun, time I made time. Why not? Can days of making sense of days that make no sense make sense? If nothing sure, but nothing sure, then reading Montesquieu must wait. Preparing for my enemies must wait. In gravity, the hurrier must wait, because forsythias are happening. They make me turn my back on forts, insurance policies, inoculations, wire, barbed or braided, bodyguards, and all that folderol of fear. They say that this year's blossoms will outlive the lasting death of Mars. There are no flowers on the stars.
Well, that's a profound line. There are no flowers on the stars. And I like the other one, the folderol of fear.
Yes.
I'm planning on using that this week, you know, because I know there's lots of people that are terrified. And so I'm, you're swimming in the folderol of fear.
Mm-hmm.
What's his name again?
Samuel Hazo.
I've heard that name, but your introduction to him makes me think that we should have heard of him. I should have heard of him a long time ago. Has he got a what's his? He's a professor of something.
He was at Duquesne, professor of English,
right,
until 1998, and then he retired. But he's still writing. His most recent book came out in 2016. So I think he's going to be one of those people like Stanley Kunitz who just keep going until they're...
All the way to 100. Yeah, yes. Right. Okay. Well, that's wonderful. That's a wonderful poem. Well, let's get another one. That's beautiful. You got me from the beginning. I like his language a lot.
Okay. I want to read a short poem. Now, he doesn't write many short poems. That's one thing I noticed. This is a short little four-line poem, but it gives you some way to understand an attitude that he's asking for you to listen to his poetry. It's called Preface to a Poetry Reading. "Since eyes are deaf and ears are blind to words in all their ways, I speak the sounds I write, hoping you will see that it somehow stays unheard and hear what is never quite clear at sight." So
well,
he's asking to listen between the words.
I find that that's... here's something that happens to me, Janet, in, you know, numerous political and social and other kinds of policy, you know, issues, people debating things about... mainly politics here. And that is, every time I hear someone assert or affirm something, you know, what comes to my mind is its inverse.
Mm-hmm.
And I blame you for that, because I think it's this infection of the poetic sensibility that's caused me to, every time I hear something, something paradoxical enters my mind, you know, and well, maybe not entirely paradoxical, but unseen.
Mm-hmm.
The unseen, difference, right? The thing not said is, there's always that, since I, you know, was a Marxist in my youth, I always used the word dialectic, but there's that that sensibility. I'm not sure, it's interesting. It should make poets good statesmen.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It should, actually, because I think statesmanship is in part a seeing of all sides. And somehow in poetry, you know, even in the affirmation of something, you know, the art of implying what's missing, you know,
yes,
as a similar method. And is that, am I getting kind of,
yeah,
part of his point here?
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that about that. I called it an infection, but I actually feel much better about it than that. I felt like it's a bomb. I'll call it a bomb instead of an infection. But so I'm going to plan on listening, just like this guy says, okay? Hear what is never quite clear at sight. Thank you.
Okay. Now I'm going to read two poems from his most recent book, They Rule the World. And the first is called Day One. And it's got an epigraph. Vision has no hierarchy, from Adam Zagajewski, a Polish poet. It's never easy being lazy in America. To learn at last that time is not money. To see the future as a fake. To watch high clouds appear and disappear like expectations or regrets. The culture's against it. The telephone's against it. The fact that this will be the first, last, and only summer of this number year is totally against it. America means doing something. Lately, I found that doing nothing's harder than doing something. It also offers time enough to let the whole world in. Riots in Cairo, Arizona wildflowers, playoffs at the Wimbledon, birthdays, baseball, or how a hummingbird can needle a lilac while fluttering fiercely in place. It's all out there, as usual. I see it all and always was. Absurd, ironic, vicious, funny, fickle, tragic, and confused. I leave the meaning of it all for afterthinkers to define in retrospect. They live for that.
That sounds like a bit of a grievance against some trend there, but yeah. But I love that one too.
I love the opening. It's never easy to be lazy.
Right. You know, I mean, for example, I find, and this has happened to me occasionally. I mean, I've been taking Tuesday mornings off, right? You know, mm-hmm, ostensibly to do some of the business related to the station. But I do find that I have spent a morning, you know, just sitting out on my back porch doing pretty much absolutely nothing. Okay. And later, when someone asks me what I did that morning, I have an impulse to, you know, make up something, right, that, mm-hmm, I did well, or to something that took a minute, you know, to say, oh, that's what I was doing, right? And so I relate to this big time. But however, let me just say I've mostly overcome my fear of being lazy. Yeah, but I like that poem. But he enlarges it, right? Mm-hmm. The whole concept by not only am I, you know, not doing something really important, I'm not, I'm paying attention to all these, the whole world, right? Mm-hmm. Which you're not doing much about, but it's all coming in. What can you do about it? I live the meaning of it all for afterthinkers to define in retrospect. They live for that. An afterthinker, huh? Mm-hmm. That's a historian or something?
Yeah. I assume so.
Yeah. All right. Let's do another one. I'm liking him. I'm really digging him. Thank you.
Okay. This next one is, it contains the phrase that's the title of the book, They Rule the World. And as I said, you know, he's now 88. And so there's, this is called Alone with Presences. It's a very poignant little poem. So just, it's a quieter poem than the ones I've read so far. Alone with presences. Paying my tax bill can wait. Some huckster hawking condos in Belize can leave a message. King Death can keep his terrors to himself for once. I live by preference in space where clocks have no hands, and time is what it is, and there is nothing else to think about. Infinity takes longer over long enough for me to reunite with those I love the most. It eases me to feel they're near, which proves those gone are never gone. I play backgammon with my father in a dream and lose and lose. I'm talking Plato with my brother in Annapolis. It's then and now where FDR and JFK stay quotably alive, while Marilyn Monroe survives and thrives in all her blonde availability. Are these as everlasting as my aunt's devotion, or my mother's smile when she sang, or how my brother faced his last epiphany without a whimper? Who says that those who've gone are ever out of sight or mind? They're present, but invisible. They visit when they choose. They rule the world.
So what's the source of that, they rule the world? I mean, that is that a, are we quoting something there? Or are we?
No, I think it's a phrase he wrote.
Okay. Well, tell me your reflection on that one. That's an interesting, they rule the world, those that have died. And how so?
I think he's coming to an age where there is present to him as those who are still alive. I mean, these are people he's loved very, very much.
I hear that because, when you get these advanced ages, I mean, all those folks that have passed on, they are with you. That's true. Well, at least some of them are. Maybe they all are.
I think that they rule the world is saying that they're important. You know, they're... rule is a word that has political overtones, but I think he's saying that this has become more important to him than politics.
Right, right. Well, it is beautiful. It's a beautiful reflection.
So I thought it was a lovely little meditation.
It's then.
I've been reading more from his book, They Rule the World, because the poems are very strong in it. It's right. Just come out. And I bought it new, which I don't normally do, and I hope my husband's not listening.
No, he is, as we know. He pays close attention, I believe. I like it. I mean, I will say that when he, it's interesting, right? Talking Plato with my brother, right? Playing backgammon with my father in a dream. And then, you know, the stuff that we all remember, right? That, you know, then and now where FDR and JFK stay quotably alive while Marilyn survives and thrives, right? And he asks interesting questions in his poems.
Yes.
You guys, another one in this set you got?
No, this is the last of that set.
Are you waiting for me, or?
Yes, I'm waiting for you.
Oh no! Am I supposed to? I'm supposed to play something, you mean?
Yes.
Oh, I thought you had one more, my dear.
I said that's the last in the set. You weren't listening.
No, I was listening to that secret voice.
Yes.
Are the hardest days, don't you worry anymore. Cause when life looks like easy street, there is danger at your door. Now think this through with me, let me know your mind. Oh, what I want to know is, are you kind? It's a buck dancer's choice, my friend. Better take my advice. You know all the rules by now, and the fire from the ice. Now will you come with me? Won't you come with me? Oh, what I want to know, will you come with me? Seen the light. There was a built cannonball. Their motto is don't tread on me. Come here, Uncle John's band, play into the tide. Come with me or go alone. He's come to take his children. Story the crow told me, it's the only one he knows. Like the morning sun you come and like the wind you go. Ain't no time to hate, barely time to wait. Oh, I want to know, where does the time go? I live in a silver mine and call it beggar's tomb. I got me a violin and I beg you call the tune. Anybody's choice, I can hear your voice. Oh, what I want to know, how does the song go? Come here, Uncle John's bear by the riverside. Beside the rising tide. Come here, Uncle John's band, play into the tide. Come on, come on, come on, he's come to take his children home. Oh, oh, I want to know, how does the song go? Uncle John's band by the riverside. Got some things to talk about here beside the rising tide. Come here, Uncle John's band, play into the tide. Come on along, go alone. He's come to take his children home.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome back to the Poetry Show here on the Enlightened Radio. This is www.enlightenradio.org, and you can get to us pretty easily on the internet, obviously. And our player is usually prominently displayed there on the in the blog, and there's a link to it called Player as well, and it's working all the time. So I hope you join us here this morning listening to the poetry. Janet has, this is the 253rd, I believe, show. And Samuel Hazo is the poet we're discussing, a wonderful poet. Let me turn your microphone on here, Janet. Hold on a second here.
Hello again. Okay, John and Carol have a marvelous garden, and so I picked some vegetative poems. And this one is called Looking into a Tulip. And it's got a great little epigraph, but I'm not sure which movie it's from, or what interview it's from. And it says, "Have you ever looked into a flower, Mr. Gable?" Grace Kelly. Looking into a Tulip. Look in, and the flower stares back. It offers you the very whites, blues, pinks, and lavenders of God. Each petal revels in the final glory of itself. For those distracted by horizons, I propose 5 minutes in the company of tulips. One tulip will suffice in all its purple understatement. Look deep and see what's primping to its prime before it fades and falls, and you'll be mesmerized for life. Brides in their wedding veils would understand. They know it's not duration, but expression that survives our days. They flower in their one-time gowns, and just once, for just one day. Even though it ends, it stays.
So these are wildflowers, right, we're talking about?
No, these are tulips.
Tulips.
These are cultivated.
And they only last for a day?
Well,
no. Well, he cuts them and puts them in a vase. I see, okay.
He's talking about the brides at that point. The ending, he's moved from tulips to the metaphor of brides that they understand. And the brides flower for one time in their one-time gowns, just once for just one day. And even though it ends, it stays. So that's referring to brides.
Yeah, okay, I got you. All right. Yeah. All right. Look deep and see what's primping to its prime before it fades and falls. All right, you have this kind of inspiration with flowers?
Not with tulips, but but I thought it was an interesting poem.
But I saw you read earlier about the Forsythia. I know you connect to the Forsythias.
Yes, I do. I love Forsythia.
All right. Okay, let's do another one.
This is called The Last Unfallen Leaf, and it's actually a fall poem, but I stuck it in here because it's a plant. The Last Unfallen Leaf. No longer green. It's topped with tan and tipped with yellow. In April, it was one of millions. In February snow, it stays, a majority of one. In a world that crowns longevity, it's king. Younger, I'd be amused. Older, I'm not sure now how being sure of anything. Who wants to be the last surviving member of a family? Or live marooned with all the fruit and coconuts you need, but not a soul in sight. Or waken as the mate still left to feel the living absence of the mate taken. The questions hurt. It's snowing harder. I want the leaf to fall.
You know, that reminds me, you'll think this is totally chaotic, but Childhood's End, you remember that story?
Yes.
You know how it ends with the hero, well, one of the heroes, who is allowed to watch as he's the last human alive, right?
Mm-hmm.
As the entire planet is consumed by this resurrection that takes place on the planet. But I remember that one of the closing lines of Childhood's End is very similar to this sentiment right here. Who wants to be the last surviving member of a family?
Mm-hmm.
And or live marooned with all the fruit and coconuts you need, but not a soul in sight. And you know, I've seen that theme in well, I mentioned Childhood's End, but it's not an uncommon theme in a lot of apocalyptic and science fiction literature, actually. You see it, you know, somewhat frequently that the guy left alone, or the woman, or the couple, or the family left alone.
The quiet earth.
Or maybe even Swiss Family Robinson, although they made friends with all the animals. But okay. What's next, my dear?
A poem called The Night Before the Snow. And I found this poem extremely intriguing, though he didn't include it in any of his selected poems. It's from a book called The Past Won't Stay Behind You, which is certainly true. The Night Before the Snow. The Maple Dreams. Sleeved in its bark hive, it dreams until the kiss of March shall rouse it from its zero sleep. Its knotted roots branch down to match beneath the trunk which gushes up to the end and downward crisscross sprays above. Its final leaves keep scudding into nooks and huddling there like cornered wrens. Leafless or not, it stays erect, intact, correct, and waits for resurrections that it knows will come. The propped impatience tell a different story. Because its only season is the sun, it won't survive the night, but it's oblivious. Lacking the maple's built-in horoscope, it blooms toward the first frost when it will blacken all at once. Part maple, part impatience, I dicker with that shrinking dream I call the future. Three thieves wait for me there. The sick thief says, a lingering will save you from your usual indulgences. The sly thief snaps. A sudden silencing confounds anticipation and defense. The old thief mumbles, age is a wheel that saddens slowly to a stop. Because each thief is right, I'm frozen in mid-argument. The maple in me counters, be prepared. All thieves exist to be outsmarted. So, outsmart. The doomed impatience whispers from its cross. A flower's born to flower, and I'm flowering. If I should die tonight, I die at my fullest, ripest best. If there's a better fate than that, what is it?
Well, that's a very nice poem. I was thinking about the... what was the line that got me here? Age is a wheel that saddens slowly to a stop.
Yes.
And that's the old thief, right?
Yes, that's the old thief.
And but this the line, the doomed impatience. Now, he spells impatience not like I-M-P-A-T-I-E-N, what,
it's
C-E.
It's a flower.
Impatience, the doomed impatience. That's a flower? An impatient
yes.
is a flower?
Yes.
Oh.
But it's an annual. It's not a perennial.
Okay. And it's actually called an impatience, huh?
Yes.
What is it? You know, have you ever seen one?
Yeah, we used to grow them. They're low to the ground, and they're really very showy, lots of bright colors.
Right, right. Okay.
But in this climate, they die because they're only annuals.
All right, okay, okay. All right. And so you have to replant them, in other words, if you
yes.
want them to... All right, cool. What's next?
One more poem, and this shows some of his humor. It's called Mismatched, and it's from his most recent book, They Rule the World. Mismatched. As regal as the blue jay looks, there's nothing regal in its squawk. What sounds like a crow's call makes his tricolor blues ignorable. Compared to all the warblers, chirpers, whistlers, and hooters in the musical sky, the jay is a contradiction. Why should it matter? The same exists at human frequencies. For years, my aunt admired the poise of a woman she wanted to meet. Introduced by chance in a theater's powder room, she said in parting, "You really are a beautiful woman." "Yes," the woman answered. "I know." Afterwards, my woman footnoted, she was great until she opened her mouth. Next, I remember a pitcher's open words when he retired. Baseball's been good to I and my family. I heard a Miss America remark as she was crowned, I'm humbled by this, and I'm so proud of my humility. In all such flubs, I note a perfect imperfection. There was the bride who chewed gum while she pronounced her vows, the master of ceremonies who called the main speaker by the wrong name, the movie star who said his marriage was consummated on the main altar of his parish church. All these remind me of the albatross who rides the wind deftly as an eagle. Circling to land, it spies a beach and spirals down with wings outspread and feet prepared to taxi. Instead, as if to prove its grace aloft has no relation to its fate aground, it manages predictably to crash and then stand and stagger off as if nothing had actually happened.
Well, I'm very impressed with that one, you know. I think I might play Bonnie's Nobody's Girl, you know, in response to that line.
I'm pretty, yes, I know. You're beautiful, I know. Right, that. She don't need anybody to tell her she's pretty. She's heard it every single day of her life. He's got to wonder what she sees in him when there's so many others standing in line. She gives herself to him, but he's still on the outside. She's alone in this world. She's nobody's girl. She's nobody's girl. She shows up at his doorstep in the middle of the night, then she disappears for weeks at a time. Just enough to keep him wanting more, but never is he satisfied. And he's left to pick up the pieces, wondering what does he do this for. She's off in her own little world. She's nobody's girl. She's nobody's girl. He said before I met her, I didn't love nothing. I could take it and leave it. That was okay. She brings out a want in me for things I didn't even know that I need. She does anything she wants, anytime she wants to, with anyone, you know, she wants it all. Still she gets all upset over the least little thing. Man, you hurt her, it makes you feel so small. And she's a walking contradiction, but I ache for her inside. Like a string of pearls, she's nobody's girl. She's fragile like a string of pearls, she's nobody's girl. She's nobody's girl. Ooh, she's nobody's girl.
Good morning and welcome back to the Poetry Show here on Enlightened Radio. You can get to Enlightened Radio on www.enlightenradio.org, and we have a blog there and lots of players and usually an update of what's going on for today. And of course today we have the Poetry Show with Janet Harrison, and this is our 253rd show. I believe we're featuring the poet of Samuel Hazel, poems of Samuel Hazel. And later this morning at noon, Fanny Crawford will be doing her storytelling with Fanny. And but from after that, we're going on hiatus here for a couple of weeks, and we're going to be reorganizing the station a little bit. And in the meantime, we'll try to play a lot of music and old-time radio for you, keep it going. We probably won't be doing any live shows until 2 weeks from the day, basically, I think would be the next one. So, in the meantime, we've been, again, listening to this wonderful poetry of Samuel Hazel. I'm just stunned by his work. And once again, of course, Janet has come up with a showing that the poetic tradition is rich in this country, just hundreds of poets that are wonderful poets. Janet, where are we going now? I just read this Seesaws poem you're about to read, and it's very powerful. Go ahead.
Okay, this is called Seesaws.
Hold on, you got to get your thing out. There you go. Try
it out. Okay, this is called Seesaws. And it's a poem that you'll have to think about a little. So I'll try and read it slowly. Seesaws. The bigger the tomb, the smaller the man. The weaker the case, the thicker the brief, the deeper the pain, the older the wound, the graver the loss, the drier the tears, the truer the shot, the slower the aim, the quicker the kiss, the sweeter the taste, the viler the crime, the vaguer the guilt, the louder the price, the cheaper the ring, the higher the climb, the sheerer the slide, the steeper the odds, the shrewder the bet, the rarer the chance, the brasher the risk, the colder the snow, the greener the spring, the braver the bull, the wiser the cape, the shorter the joke, the surer the laugh, the sadder the tale, the dearer the joy, the longer the life, the briefer the years.
Well, that was a powerful close. I mean, that's beautifully done. That must have been a hard poem to write.
Yes, I think so.
Hold on, let me get my phone out of the way of the electronics. Somehow, it tends to make me. All right, let's do it. I think that speaks for itself. I mean, it's a. I think friends, if they're going to read this, I mean, it stands being read from the page a little bit. It's a. Although it works, it's so balanced. Even though the louder the price, the cheaper the ring.
Yes.
What does that mean?
You think? I think, you know, when you're shouting that something is.
Oh, like, yeah, down the middle aisle, Kmart shoppers, you'll find a wonderful special.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, right, okay.
Shopping channel.
Right, okay, right, all right. Let's hear another one. That's a beautiful poem, Janet.
Okay, this is one of two political poems I've included, and this is a very beautiful poem called Suffer the Little Children, and Sarah is one of his three grandchildren. Suffer the Little Children. Just 4 months into history, Sarah speaks in the key of squeaks while reaching for her rattle. Nothing distracts her but a televised explosion followed by screaming. Her father meets the scream. Screen. The screams sound louder in the silence. Powdered by bomb dust, remnants of children litter a street in Quanah. Rescuers bundle bodies and bits into oriental rugs for burial. I turn away to graze at Sarah, sucking on her rattle. As image overlaps with image, bomb dust seems to whiten her cheeks. I make a face to see if she will laugh. She waits until my face becomes my face and then blooms into a grin. The silence keeps on screaming.
Wow. Well, it's an anti-war poem, that's for sure.
Well, he's a very strong anti-war person.
Yeah. Wow. Was he one of the member of the peace churches at all, or just is this individual?
I think he's Catholic.
Okay. All right. Interesting. Very interesting poem. Suffer the Little Children. Whoa, boy. That is a powerful poem.
Okay. And this next one I chose specifically for you, John.
I know. I read it.
And it's from They Rule the World, which was published by Syracuse University Press in 1916. I pledge allegiance to rebellion. I pay attention to revolts. They clear the air. They show that not accepting what is unacceptable is always possible. Even a failed resistance seems to me much nobler than surrendering. It's not a question of defeat or triumph. Resistors rarely win, but win or lose, they stay in mind. They last. After his stroke, my father would not accept his condition. Refusal let him feel complete and still in charge. He died refusing. Emanuel Goldenberg retained the G in his stage name so the world would know that Edward G. Robinson was proudly and defiantly a Jew. Informed that his leukemia was lethal, Edward Said rebelled for 11 years by authoring books he never would have written otherwise. Refusal arms us to contend with issues grave or small. They could be ultimate as death or common as weeding a garden, shoveling driveway snow, or shaving. I leave all further talk of consequence, rewards, or deeper meanings to the gods. I only know that I feel most myself when I say no to what deserves a no, exactly when the no is needed. To those obsessed with outcomes, I suggest that what matters first is always the choice, the stance.
That's very interesting to me, of course. And I, the clothes, you know, having spent a, you know, a good part of my life in one form of rebellion or another, you know, I, as age disabused me of the opinion at the end of that there that it doesn't matter if you win. It does.
It's not saying it doesn't matter. He's saying that even if you only try when you're sure you're going to win, you're making a mistake.
Well, that's true. I mean, but nevertheless, the luck losing can cost you.
Okay. It can cost you, but you have to make your choice.
That's true. Well, this is, you know, he's I'm just surprised I haven't heard of him before. He's just very powerful. I mean, and
and very prolific. I mean, he's written everything.
Wow, right. He must get up every morning and do the...
I don't know how he does it.
And well, he probably has less things, other things. He has uncluttered his schedule, okay? And he's got his priorities down. Right is first, mm-hmm. You know? So maybe that's the...
That's great. I don't know. Let's play a little too.
Mm-hmm. And hold on one second. Well, that was Richard Thompson, of course, from his, well, maybe not of course, but in case you didn't recognize it from a newly released acoustic classics album, I think Janet actually saw Richard Thompson recently. Let me turn her microphone on.
There you go. Yes, I did, and he was fabulous, and he did that song live.
Oh, well, yeah, it's one of his great ones, Well, we're listening to the reading the poetry of Samuel Hazel today, and it's a profound experience. I'm really loving this poetry. Janet, where are we going now? Those last poems were just spectacular.
Okay, we're going to do some poems he wrote about writing, which all writers tend to do at some time. And this first is called King Nothing. Black dog was Churchill's phrase for what I'm facing here. I keep reporting to my desk, my pen, my books, but nothing comes of it. I'm spared confirming Montesquieu's, a man can play the fool in everything but poetry. I'm out of poetry right now. Seamus would shrug and say, when you have nothing to write, write nothing. Better than writing badly. Better than fraud. On T-shirts, matchbooks, and bumper stickers, fraud has risen to final solutions. Send a Cuban home for Christmas. Sickle cell anemia is the great white hope. Arabs can go and reproduce themselves. The isms in the word explode like spittle in my face. If all we do begins in our imagining, I should expect the worst more often than the best. It sells. It meets the needs of hate. It happens on command. It lacks the lightning of the best, which comes when it comes to right, the way a dance will dance the dancers when the dance is right. Like love, it lets the eyes become the face's sky again and takes us where it takes us, never soon enough, but not too late. As long as that's worth waiting for, I'll wait.
Better to write nothing than write badly?
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
I'm not sure everybody follows that particular...
No, William Stafford certainly didn't.
Yeah. I mean, I would think that just, you know, pl-
plunging ahead might also work, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. But that's a very nice, these Ars Poetica kind of poems are, you know, maybe not everybody is into them as much, but I know that anyone that likes to study poetry or read it, you know, the Ars Poetica poems are, they're nice. They get into the writing, the act of writing, which is the work that, you know, these writers are doing. And that always is revelatory to me. So I'm enjoying this. Go ahead.
Okay, the next is another poem. It's called Voodoo. Profession, wordsmith. Ambition, only to leave America no loss, no worse because I wrote it. Failings, truculence beyond reason. Tell me I can't be disappointed and believe, and disappointed, I'll go on believing. Suggest I roam for inspiration, and I'll say the knife I hone in my own room could cut no keener in Japan, Geneva, or the Hebrides. Call poetry the voodoo of the mad, and I'll explain how madness keeps me sane. Better mad than futile. Defenses. Search me and you'll find no automatic hidden in my pocket like pornography. No shield except an aging epidermis fuzzed with hair. No tactic, but the ruse of trust. Results? Who knows? It's still the price of love to fight the battle for the future now and lose. At least I know what I'll say no or yes to before I must. Meanwhile, I stay a breath away from God and write down what I just remember. A word here, a phrase there. Not much to memorize unless a consecration comes to make them worth remembering. But if and when it comes, then watch me stitch my dreams to syllables, connive with pens like some magician in a frenzy, shake to hell the 7-come-11 world, and make what's happening my heaven.
Nearly perfect, in my view. Just that's profession, wordsmith. Ambition, only to leave America no worse because I wrote it. What a wonderful line, really. I mean, as all of the, but the one that got me, no tactic but the ruse of trust. That got me the key line for me. Mm-hmm. And because trust, the ruse of trust. We hope it's not a ruse, but we find so often that it is, right? That's mm-hmm. the, or we thought we understood the trust, but maybe we didn't. I don't know. Tell me about your reaction to that poem. I find that.
I was caught seductive, later on, yeah, down when it says it's still the price of love to fight the battle for the future now. And the fact that. He's not going to carry a gun. He's not going to carry a shield. He's going to try the tactic of trust, even if it looks like a ruse. Still the price of love to fight. I thought there was just and I stay a breath away from God and write down what I just remember. I thought there's some beautiful lines in this poem.
Lots of them, yeah. I mean, he has a great sensitivity. He really does. He's obviously terribly fluent, you know, as well. So the two work together. Mm-hmm. All right, is that the last one on this set, or are you got another one?
There's one more. And this is from his most recent book. And it's got this great title, The Poem's Only Deadline is Perfection. After you start to write it, you belong to the poem. Your time becomes the poem's time, which ranges anywhere from now to who knows when. You're like a sculptor working with a mallet, wedge, and file to help the sculpture waiting in a bulk of rock emerge. Like something born in hiding, a poem lets itself be found the more you fret and work to free it of its flaws. Even when the poem seems complete, you're still not sure of a verb here, an adjective there. You squander hours searching for alternatives until they both occur to you by chance while you're thinking of something else entirely. There's no timetable. You pause when the poem makes you pause. You write when the poem makes you write. Precedent means nothing. And even when you think you're done, it's never done. You tell yourself you could have made it better, but if the time for bettering is over, being a poet means you have to live with that.
Now, that is certainly true, right? And I know you've, my own little attempts at poetry, certainly verify that, okay? Even when you think it's done, it's never done. But then you have to learn to live with that. And now that process of when you learn to live with it rather than leaving it, then when it reaches perfection, this was a subject when Dr. Hanrahan was in, we were talking about Emily Dickinson. You know, what is a finished Emily Dickinson poem, since she never published very many of them, or hardly any of them, right? and there were more than one version found, and sometimes it was like found on the back of an envelope where you couldn't tell exactly which verse came before the other. Is it ever finished?
Well, the great line about that is the poem is never finished, it's only abandoned. And that's Paul Valéry, the French
critic. I like that one too.
That's my favorite. I never feel like a poem's finished. I always feel like I'm abandoning them. But the trick is to abandon the poem in an interesting place.
No, I like that. That's an interesting remark. Okay, we found that it's interesting. It may not be perfect, but it's interesting. So we'll leave it. Let it see if it can walk on its own. It has any legs at all. All right. Well, should I play a tune now and we'll come back? Okay, good. What's the next here?
I hear the drizzle of the rain, like a memory it falls, soft and warm continuing, tapping on my roof and walls. And from the shelter of my mind, through the window of my eyes, I gaze beyond the rain-drenched streets to England where my heart lies. My mind's distracted and diffused. My thoughts are many miles away. They lie with you when you're asleep, kiss you when you start your day. And a song I was writing is left undone. I don't know why I spend my time writing songs I can't be. Words that tear and strain to rhyme.
And good morning and welcome back to the Poetry Show here on enlightenradio.org. You can, of course, www.enlightenradio.org will take you to our blog and also a link to our players. And hope you can join us anytime. By the way, coming up at noon today, Fanny Crawford will be doing her storytelling show. And following that, we'll be taking a bit of a live programming break here for a couple of weeks while we kind of restructure the station. And in the meantime, Janet has found just a wonderful poet today, Samuel Hazel, and I'm just blown away by him. He's just great. I wish I'd
encountered him before. So what do we got now, Janet?
Okay, we have four poems to close on. And the first is called God and Man. It's one of his short poems, which he hardly ever writes. It's a five-line poem, God and Man. After casting the first act, checking sections of scenery, and mastering his rage because the female lead blundered on page one, he left the actors to themselves on stage without a script and fretting for directions.
Well, you know, now that's a paraphrase of a Rilke poem.
Mm-hmm.
Because Rilke has one of his little religious poems where he basically says the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
He ignored, in fact, barely ever spoke to Eve, and Eve took Adam from him. It's kind of a similar, left the stage to themselves without a script and fretting for direction. I think in Rilke's thing, he says that God leaves and never comes back or something mm-hmm. like that, but... or at least in that one particular poem. yeah, I actually like that poem and that sentiment. And the reason I like it is because it's, and there's more than one poet that does this, is that I think one of the revelations that you need, that that wisdom should bring you, is that it's on us. No one's coming over the hill to save us. And sometimes, you know, religion and God, someone views, oh, gee, you know, the whole thing has gone to heck, and, you know, we need the Lord to come in and save us all. And I like the poems, and I like both the, and also the postures that say, no, you know, he's, I like it, even if you have to write it so that God got upset and we weren't loyal and he took off and decided to pay attention to some other universe for a while. You know, I like the sense that, hey, it's in our hands, and it's in our destiny. We set it ourselves, and I really like that sentiment, and so I like that poem, too. Go ahead. I know it's short. You could talk forever about that poem, but I love it. Very nice.
Okay, well, this is going to provide a bit of a contrast, because this is a poem that's set in Ireland. It's called The Real Reason for Going Is Not Just to Get There. It's got a lot of wonderful Irish names in it. Kilnarney's maps are for the unredeemed. The hidden land awaits the stumblers and the temporarily confused who find their destinations as they go. In Dingle, there's history, bone final as the faith that founded Galaris. All that remains of what was there when Galaris began. God, man, sheep, and stone, and stone, and stone. Dingles ago, the starvers saw their lips turn green from chewing grass before they famished in their beds, their hovels bleached like tombs, unreached and riven by the sea. If only all the stones were beige or marble white. Their fading grays seem unforgiving as fate, that only wit or tears or emigration can defeat. Sheep graze over graves. Loud gulls convene on garbage dunks. In Galway, Cashel, and Trelloc, I fish the air for what it is that makes the Irish Irish. It's Seamus speaking Sweeney's prayer in health and telling me of Hopkins, the convert, buried in Glasnevin. How it sounds to sing the music in a name. Skibbereen, Balregan, Kilbeggan, Bunratty, Listowel, Duncannon, Fermagal, Ballyconnolly. Is it Joyce's map of metaphors that makes Dublin mythical as Greece? Is it cairns of uniambic and unrhyming rocks transformed by hand into the perfect palm of a wall? Is it the priest near death who whispered, give my love to Roscommon and the horses of Roscommon? Is it because the Irish pray alike for Pope John Paul, our Bishop Eamon, and Ned O'Toole, late of Mollycoole? Inside God's house or out, their sadder smiles say the world, if given time, will break your heart. with such a creed they should believe in nothing but the wisdom of suspicion. Instead, they say, please God, and fear ahead regardless of the odds to show that life and God deserve at least some trust, some fearlessness, some courtesy.
Oh, yeah. Well, that, well, you know, now that would be a fun, I bet you if you could get someone like Seamus, right,
who
has this wonderful Irish brogue, right, or not overpowering, but it's there, and all those were Skibbereen, Balrigan, Kilbeg. I'm trying to mimic Irish.
Yeah.
They are beautiful words, you know, they really are. And now that he must have just visited Dublin. He's not a Dubliner, buddy.
No, he was born in. As I said, he's the son of Syrian and Lebanese immigrants. He was born in Pittsburgh.
And he clearly has a friendship with Seamus Heaney.
Seamus Heaney brought over to speak at Pittsburgh, and they have a correspondence.
Okay. Well, I just love that poem. It's very Irish, and I think I'll bet Seamus liked it too.
Yes. And this next is called The Holy Surprise of Right Now. It's got this great epigraph by Joseph Campbell. If you can see your path laid out ahead of you, step by step, then you know it's not your path. Joseph Campbell. The Holy Surprise of Right Now. Inside Brooks Brothers windows, it's July. Sport shirts and sleek dummies speak in turquoise, polo, Bermuda, and golf. Outside, it's very much the 1st of March. The sport charts say today's tomorrow, and the present tense be damned. They tell me to forget that here is the only place we have. They claim what matters most is never now, but the next. I've heard this argument before. It leaves me sentenced to the future, and that's much worse than being sentenced to the past. The past, at least, was real, just once. What's called religion offers me the same. Life's never what I have, but what's to come. But where did Christ give heaven its address except within each of us? So anyone who claims it's not within, but still ahead, is contradicting God. But why go on? I'm sick of learning to anticipate. I never want to live a second or a season or a heaven in advance of when I am and where. I need the salt and spices of uncertainty to know I'm still alive. It makes me hunger for the feast I call today. It lets desire keep what satisfaction ends. Lovers remember the way that smoke, remember that the way smoke remembers fire. Between anticipation and the aggravation of suspense, I choose suspense. I choose desire.
Well, that's beautiful, and he's just a magnificent poet. And
got one more, John.
Oh, you do? Oh, because I thought that one was just like penultimate.
Yes, it is. The last one's called Overheard. I wanted to end with one from The Rule of the World, his most recent book, because I think it's a very intriguing book. Overheard. All those who listen with their eyes agree that silence is speech at its truest. It's not the silence of libraries, study halls, infirmaries, ballisticas, or anywhere made quiet by tradition, purpose, or demand. It's more than the absence of sound. Even the deaf can hear it. Decades ago, I wrote a book called Silence Spoken Here, to show that science alone is understandable without translation, everywhere, by everybody, always. Why else do authors in France gather each year in Nice to discuss the mystery of Le Silence? I'd like to be there once to add my 2 cents worth of relevance. Who hasn't heard the mute silence following a funeral, the silent gratitude of being remembered by coincidence, or the paired silence shared by twins? Lovers, after all, say everything there is to say by saying nothing when they touch. That's how whatever is touched by love reflects and then outlives the silence that created it. Between the lines of palms, hides another poem, everlasting but invisible. It's what you keep on hearing when the poem's over. Listen.
Well, thank you, Janet. That was he's a magnificent poet, and I'm glad you found him. Had you heard of him before?
I had one of his books, but I had never really studied him. And when I went into his biography, I was just fascinated by how prolific and how much he's written and how much he's done. And it was just...
he's done plays, too?
He's done about 6 or 7 plays. He's written a film script. He's written novels. He's written essays.
Have you read any of his prose?
Yes, I read some. I pulled out some of his short essays, and I was really very intrigued by them.
Oh, I got to look him up because he sounds just fascinating to me. Really,
and he's written speeches. He's written some. I haven't read some of his more. I read some of his political poems, but some of his poems are quite political. He's very active.
Right. Okay. Well, he's just magnificent. So Samuel Hazo, and folks, if you want to pick up a get an interest in this poet and find out more about him, why don't you go into the Four Seasons bookstore here at Shepherdstown, 114 German Street, and talk to our good buddy Mike Robertus or Kendra or some of the other folks there. And they have a great poetry section in the bookstore that we check out all the time. And if he doesn't have Samuel Hazo's latest book there, which is To Rule the World, right?
They Rule the World.
They Rule the World, then I'm sure that Mike can get it for you in a day or two. And so check it out. Anyway, thank you guys for tuning in to the Poetry Show here on Monday. We'll be back in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, take care of each other. It's late, but everything comes next. That's, of course, a line from Naomi Shihab Nye's great poem, Jerusalem. We'll be back in a little bit. We'll play some music. And then stay tuned at noon for Storytelling with Fanny Crawford.
In another lifetime, one of toil and blood, when blackness was a virtue, the road was full of mud. I came in from the wilderness,